The creation of justice in community requires the organization of power. The creation of justice in community requires the organization of power, says the Unitarian theologian James Luther Adams. So this strenuous work of organizing power is necessary for the incarnation of justice, the embodiment of justice, the reality of justice. A vision of justice that stays in the realm of ideal, thought, word, principle, but is not embodied, is undependable, and ultimately impotent. These are strong and prophetic words. The organization of power is at the heart of the matter of our exploration today, as we take a look at a piece of local labor history on this anniversary of the Lawrence textile strikes in 1912, and as we consider some of its implications. The story of the Lawrence strike is very compelling and worthy of remembering in and of itself, but our work together in faith community is to not only learn together, but to engage in spiritual and moral inquiry. And in this case, into the structures of power which uphold human dignity and relations and well-being, or diminish human dignity, human relations and well-being, and to inquire into our own relationship to those same structures. So we'll begin with the story of the textile strike, also known as the Bread and Roses Strike, or the Strike for Three Loaves, and a bit later we'll bring in some theological reflection to view this history and its legacy in our time. So 100 years ago, in January 1912, in the textile mill town of Lawrence, which is about 40 miles north as the crow flies from Boston, an unlikely organization of power came about with the unionization and the coordination of coordinated striking of more than 20,000 workers, many of them women, most of them immigrants, of English, Irish, German, French-Canadian, Italian, Slavic, Hungarian, Portuguese, and Syrian descent, as well as other ethnicities. And in spite of the fact that these workers spoke as many as 25 different languages, in spite of the fact that the mill employers had for decades deliberately cultivated an atmosphere of competition, division, and hostility between these ethnic groups, in spite of the even further oppressed and diminished status of women, in spite of the unholy and unquestioned marriage of capitalist government and judicial powers, with their bias towards profit and their shared contempt for the working poor, and in spite of the use of jailing, militias, and violence to suppress the strike, the workers held their protest under increasingly brutal conditions for 2 months and ultimately won their cause, which was a 15% increase in their already meager wages, a 54-hour work week, double pay for overtime, and no repercussions for those who had participated in the strike. The momentum that came out of this unlikely success spurred a whole wave of further pro-labor actions and achievements across the Northeast, helping to bring new awareness about the plight of workers and new legislations that would improve the conditions for workers across the country. The period from 1900 to 1920 saw a huge surge in activism in the U.S. labor movement, and the Lawrence strike was a key part of that surge. So in these days of the Lawrence strike anniversary, it's important to remember the incredible sacrifice and courage of seemingly powerless people who struggled and fought so that they and their children and future generations of workers might have a basic measure of justice and dignity and hope. And it's because of these folks, that workers over time eventually won rights and conditions that we have been able to take for granted in our time, perhaps until recently. An 8-hour workday, a minimum wage, paid overtime, the weekend, an end to child labor, anti-discrimination laws, safety regulations, benefits, and collective bargaining rights. But let's go back a ways in order to understand what Lawrence workers were experiencing in the first place back in 1912. So from the mid-19th century, there had been this dizzying progression of industrialization. And by the turn of the 20th century, Lawrence had become an epicenter of the most modern and intensified industrial practices. It was a symbol of the whole industrial system, both its unprecedented capacity for production and also in its exploitation of its workers. The Lawrence textile factories were enormous for their time. They were unprecedented in their size. They were huge lofts filled with high-speed, deafeningly loud, and dangerous machines, operated by thousands of laborers, most of whom did endlessly repetitive, unskilled work, 10 hours a day or more, with a half an hour break for lunch, 6 or 7 days a week. Whole families worked in the mills out of necessity, with women earning significantly less than men, and children earning less than women, even if all were doing equal work. Since much of the repetitive labor didn't require strength, but only speed and nimbleness, and the fact that children could do the same work as adults and be paid much less made child labor especially profitable. To keep up with the increased demands for product and the hunger for profit, the employers would simply run the machines faster. They would speed up the engines when they had to push for greater production, creating incredibly dangerous conditions where people could hardly keep pace with the machines. If they lost focus for a moment, and they were often exhausted and hungry, the workers could lose fingers, hands, arms, or worse. Women's hair could easily get caught in the machines, tearing the scalp out, or pulling them headfirst into the mechanisms. Employers took little responsibility and offered little compensation when such accidents occurred. The air was filled with floating wool and cotton fibers that clogged the nose and the lungs. Stressful, dangerous work, malnourishment, dark, crowded, and filthy tenement housing, and unhealthy air brought a high mortality rate. 36 out of 100 men and women who worked in the mills died by the time they reached 25. For children, the mortality rate was 50% by the age of 6. Vida Dutton Scudder, professor at Wellesley College, who eventually spoke at one of the strikers' rallies, said, "If the women of this country knew how cloth was made in Lawrence and at what price of human life, they would never buy another yard." But the deluge of impoverished immigrants coming into the Northeast flooded the area with unskilled laborers willing to accept the dismal and dangerous working and living conditions, the low pay and the long hours, and the owners had no reason to value their workers, and so they exploited the situation to the utmost. The workers lived on bread, molasses, and beans. That was their diet. It was all they could afford. Sanitation was so poor and the water so polluted that the employers had to import drinking water from elsewhere, and then they charged the workers through the nose to drink it. Now, ironically, it's very long work hours, but it was the passing of a new Massachusetts law effective in January 1st, 1912, that reduced the maximum number of work hours for women and children from 56 to a grand 54. This set the stage for the strike because the mill owners compensated for the loss of that labor by cutting the workers' weekly pay by 32 cents. And this translated into families being able to buy three less loaves of bread per week. And when the strike began, it was known as the strike for three loaves for this reason. Now, we don't have time to go into the whole arc of the story of the Lawrence strike. There's a lot of detail. But there are a few things that I'd like to highlight. The first is that the strike was successful largely because of the leadership of the Radical Socialist Union, the Industrial Workers of the World, or the IWW. This union sent experienced organizers to Lawrence who could speak multiple languages and who helped to create the organizational infrastructure for a prolonged protest. So they had representatives from each language group, and they had channels of communication and subcommittees, and they created this whole infrastructure that would allow all of these diverse peoples to come together and work together. And their tactics express beautifully what James Luther Adams called the organization of power that is a necessary precursor to the realization of justice. It was actually the first time that such large numbers of unskilled laborers had been organized under the radical vision of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. And it was very threatening to the powers that be. There were fears of anarchy and class revolution as a result of this. And for a long time, they were vilified in the paper because of that. The IWW leaders worked on three fronts. They called upon and sort of created a national network of sympathetic helpers who funneled money and resources and services into the area in support of the strike from all over the country. They gave order to the communications and efforts of the local strikers, and they inspired them ideologically. They gave them a sense of dignity and worth and the moral and spiritual legitimacy of their struggle. They gave them the language, the ideological power to do what they were doing, to believe in themselves. So relief committees and a network of soup kitchens and food distribution stations were set up by each nationality group, and each center cared for hundreds of families each week. Volunteer doctors and nurses came to Lawrence to provide medical services. Families received a few dollars a week from funds that were raised from across the country in response to the strike committee's appeal. And this last piece is particularly moving to me because extremely poor people all over the country gave money that they could not afford to give away. But they gave it in donation to the Lawrence strikers, hoping and believing that the protest in Lawrence might become a watershed moment in their shared effort as laborers across the country, their shared struggle. All in all, the issue of relief was handled so effectively that during the 10-week strike, the strikers were able to focus unwaveringly on their goal. And this was also unprecedented, that level of collective support for the effort. Incidentally, the Lawrence strikers are credited with inventing the moving picket line, because they would have been arrested for loitering. So what we've come to understand is that a basic premise for striking was created there. The second thing I want to lift up about this strike was this singing. The inspiration that the workers felt and expressed gave rise to this distinctive characteristic of the Lawrence strike. The people sang. They sang their way through weeks of protest, earning their cause another nickname, which was the singing strike. The labor reporter Mary Heaton Vorse wrote at the time, "It was the spirit of the workers that was dangerous. They are always marching and singing. The tired gray crowds ebbing and flowing perpetually into the mills had waked and opened their mouths to sing. And the poem and song, Bread and Roses, became one of those rallying points, signifying the need not only for basic physical sustenance, but the needs of the soul as well, the need for spiritual dignity and beauty and quality of life. And in the American magazine, the journalist Ray Stannard Baker wrote, "It is not short of amazing the power of a great idea to weld men together. There was in it a peculiar, intense, vital spirit, a religious spirit, if you will, that I have never before felt in any strike. At first, everyone predicted that it would be impossible to bold these divergent people together, but comparatively few went back to the mills." The third point that I want to lift up is that public opinion was finally turned decisively in favor of the workers as a result of a tactic called the children's exodus. Now, in spite of the efforts of the protest to go on peacefully, the strikers were increasingly subject themselves to violence at the hand of hired militias and police. And this very day, January 29th, a young woman was shot to death by police during a chaotic scuffle as the tensions and clashes mounted. And the situation had become so dangerous that it was deemed necessary to remove the children en masse from Lawrence, sending them to sympathetic homes in other areas. And the world's eyes were on Lawrence as the children were ushered in orderly lines to the train station. And what the world saw was a parade of the most ragged, filthy, barefooted, skinny-legged, malnourished little slum waves. In fact, when 92 children arrived in New York City to go to their foster homes, they paraded in their rags with banners down Fifth Avenue on the way to their foster homes. And the Lawrence authorities realized that these kids were making them look really bad. And they made a botched attempt to stop the next waves of the children's exodus by force. And they ended up treating the separating mothers and children so brutally that an outcry went up from decent folks all across the nation. And newspapers and magazines focused national attention at this point on the conflict. And protests from every part of the country reached Congress. And finally, a congressional investigation was made of the Lawrence situation. Hearings were held and were attended by President Taft's wife, Nellie. And finally, the president ordered an investigation of industrial conditions throughout the nation. And what hits me about this situation is that the workers' conditions had been terrible for decades. The children had been starving and dying. The people had been exploited and maimed. And yet the public and the press had largely turned a blind eye to the situation of industrial workers. The nation enjoyed an increase in machine-made material goods. The middle class was growing. And particularly a few at the top reaped enormous profits from mass production. And it took the public really being poked in the eye by these horrifying images of blatant exploitation and suffering before the public cried foul. And this brings us back to the question, what does this story have to do with us? What light does this history throw upon our situation today? I just want to mention at this point a recent episode of This American Life from Public Radio International called Mr. Daisy and the Apple Factory. I don't know if anyone heard this. I see a few nodding heads. Yes. The show is the story of Mike Daisy, who describes himself as a worshiper in the cult of Mac. And, he just has an obsession with Macintosh products, which he thought... were just the coolest of the cool. But His curiosity is piqued when he sees some photos of the inside of the Apple factory in Shenzhen, China, which is the city where most of the, quote, crap that we get from China is manufactured. I mean, just this small town was like a little village, and it's now a city of some, I think, 40 million people, and all they do is manufacture stuff for the U.S. and other Western nations. So Mike Daisy travels to Shenzhen to see what's really going on, and he encounters an environment of such dehumanizing Orwellian oppression of workers that it shatters his world. And this is a long story in itself, and I can't go into it here, but I recommend that you track down the archived episode and listen to it if you want to understand the connection between the cheap goods that we enjoy and the actual cost of that cheapness to the lives of human beings. Yeah, I hear you saying it's not cheap.
We don't get the profits.
What's that?
We don't get the profits from those goods.
Right. Well, they're actually very expensive, and they're expensive in lives. They're expensive in environmental degradation, and they're expensive in social degradation. So the struggle to embody labor justice is as relevant today as it has ever been. And the forces that place profit far above human life are as brutal as they were in 1912. Both here and abroad. And I want to take us in these last few minutes back to the Unitarian theologian James Luther Adams as we bring some theological frameworks to this exploration. So Adams calls his essay The Five Smooth Stones of Liberalism. And this is sort of a side point, but I think it's an interesting one. Where does he get this metaphor of the five smooth stones? Where does that come from? Where does the image come from? It comes, in fact, from the biblical story of David and Goliath. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 40, which is a story that we met a couple of weeks ago. Just to give a little synopsis, in the story, the Israelite army and the Philistine army are camped out on two hills with a grassy plain between them, and they're in this standoff. And every day, the champion, Goliath, comes out swaggering and goading the Israelites to send out their champion to meet him, mano a mano. And the king of the Israelites is paralyzed and utterly intimidated, and he can't act decisively. And the Israelites are increasingly demoralized by Goliath's antics. And King Saul hears about this precocious teenager, David, who's been hanging out in the soldiers' camp, who's just itching to go out and meet Goliath. And even though this seems entirely foolhardy, Saul calls for David and questions him. And he finds this young man fierce and shining with courage and conviction and faith. And so he agrees to let him meet Goliath, but he prepares him for battle by dressing him in a full coat of armor with a helmet and a sword. But when David tries walking around in all this clanking gear, he knows it will only hinder and weaken him. So he takes it all off again. And he goes to the riverbed and chooses five smooth stones, putting them in his shepherd's pouch. And these stones and his leather slingshot are the only weaponry that he will take with him to face the giant that he ultimately defeats. So in literary tradition, the five smooth stones have come to mean a set of simple, essential qualities, strengths, tools, or weapons by which a skilled underdog may triumph over a seemingly superior foe. And it's in this tradition that James Luther Adams takes up the metaphor in his discussion of the fundamentals of religious liberalism. So what are the five smooth stones? According to Adams, they are these. First, and these are his words. I'll begin with a quote taken from his text and then a little just sort of clarifying explanation. Religious liberalism depends on the principle that revelation is continuous. In other words, our religious tradition is a living tradition because we are always learning new truths. We believe that truth is always being revealed, that it's not fixed in scripture or in the past. So we're a community of learning, and we need to be continuously willing to seek truth. We need to be continuously willing to open ourselves to truth that was not apparent to us before. So that's the first smooth stone. Religious liberalism depends on the principle that revelation is continuous. The second smooth stone is that all relations between persons ought ideally to rest on mutual free consent and not on coercion. We freely choose to enter into relationship with each other, so we need to look at conditions in which people are coerced into the conditions, into the working conditions, or into the relationships that they exist in. Religious liberalism, this is the third smooth stone, religious liberalism affirms the moral obligation to direct one's effort toward the establishment of a just and loving community. Religious liberalism, I would say, confronts us with a moral obligation to direct our efforts into the establishment of a just and loving community. So we're called by our faith to work for justice and love in human society. That's the third smooth stone. Fourth, we deny the immaculate conception of virtue and affirm the necessity of social incarnation. So this is his fancy way of saying that good things don't just happen. People make them happen. So it's the embodiment of justice that counts. This requires the organization of power in the service of justice. And the fifth smooth stone is that liberalism holds the resources, both divine and human, that are available for the achievement of meaningful change, and they justify an attitude of ultimate optimism. There is reason for hope. Hope is found in the energy and commitment of all those who dedicate themselves in great and small ways to the achievement of justice, peace, and dignity, and the flowering of culture. And hope is found in the spirit which moves such commitment. So I'm going to just say what the five smooth stones are as succinctly as I can. The first one is that we're continuously learning new truth. The second is that we need to be in free relation with each other, not coerced relationship. The third is that we are called to establish a just and loving society. The fourth is that we make things happen by our will and embodiment of justice. It doesn't just happen by itself, and it doesn't happen just because we think about it. And the fourth is that there's reason for hope, spiritual and human. And this is why we come together in community, to be reminded that the embodiment of love is possible, to be reminded that the organization of power in service of love and justice is possible, and that we're called to do it, to be replenished and inspired by the spiritual resources that are there for us, in ourselves, in each other, in the exemplars in our world and in history, and to be replenished and inspired by the great powers of life, whether we call it God or however we understand it, the spiritual powers that give us the energy and the capacity to do these things. And we come together to be strengthened in our call to create a loving community and a larger society, a loving, larger society together. So the challenges of working people and the conditions that oppress them are as real as they have ever been. And the conditions are very pivotal right now, because there are a lot of rights that are becoming eroded. And one of the things that I discovered that I encountered in my exploration of labor history was the notion that the United States is actually a more hostile environment for labor vision and values than other European nations, that capitalism is a very powerful force in our society that will, in whatever way it can, undermine the workers' efforts toward rights, equality, fair pay. And so we're still called upon to do this work that was done 100 years ago. And so, like David, let us gather up our 5 smooth stones, our sources of spiritual power, and be willing to face the Goliaths of our time, singing and shining in courage and faith and community. May it be so. So let's sing together, following the example of our forebears. We're going to sing together. We're not going to do the reading that's there, but we'll sing together hymn number 114, Forward Through the Ages. Please rise in body or spirit. Closing words are from the original Constitution of the American Mine Workers Union.